Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Mugwump Tower, this is Albatross 1-3, requesting permission to land. Over.
I don't need a computer to tell me how to land a damn airplane.
Six.
Heads up display, check.
Five.
Lasers, check.
Four.
Particle beam, check.
Three.
Proton bolts, check.
Two.
Chair control, check.
One.
Let's do it.
Broadcasting from a secret underground location somewhere in Mos Eisley, this is the Docking Bay 77 podcast. Make yourself comfortable. The show is about to start. Hello and welcome to the Docking Bay 77 podcast. I am your host, Dayton Johnson. I'll be playing the part of Christoph, the creator and villain of our show. Let me introduce the rest of our cast. We have playing the part of Marlin, our special guest, Michael Burgett from the Screen Nerds podcast. How's it going, Michael?
It's going great. And I'm glad I'm Marlin because, as we established on the last episode I was on, how much I love that actor. So perfect casting right there.
That was the idea. I pay attention, believe it or not. And playing the part of Sylvia, or is it Meryl? She can decide.
No, Sylvia. I was like, if he calls me Meryl, I'm going to die.
It is Amber Lewis. How's it going, Amber?
Oh, really, really well.
And playing the part of our hero, Truman Burbank, it is Robert Burnett. How's it going, Robert?
Well, good morning. Or if I don't see you later, good afternoon. Yeah, you know how it goes. Anyway,
yeah, I know it.
I'm great. Thank you.
Yeah, I used to actually have that in our first intro. That was one of the sound clips I had. So, because that's how much I enjoy this movie. Yep. So, yes, we are discussing the 1998 film starring Jim Carrey and directed by Peter Weir. It is The Truman Show.
Comments are still headed.
What else is on?
Yeah, let's see what else. First.
Coming to you now from the largest studio ever constructed, it's The Truman Show!
Yeah!
Good morning!
Good morning!
Oh, and in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
What if?
No scripts, no cue cards.
Morning, Spencer!
How's it going?
What if you were watched every moment of your life?
How many cameras you got there in that town?
5,000.
I believe Truman is the first child to have been legally adopted by a corporation.
That's correct.
Brilliant.
What if everyone you knew was pretending?
Hi, honey. Look what I got at the checkout. Dishwasher safe.
That's amazing.
What if your world was make-believe?
Cue the sun. While the world he inhabits is counterfeit.
I'm not allowed to talk to you.
That's how I look. Not your type.
There's nothing fake about Truman himself.
What if you didn't know it until now?
A lot of strange things have been happening.
Stand by ring cam.
Is he looking at us?
Does he think he knows?
I think I'm mixed up in something.
Something big.
Oh. We accept the reality with which we're presented.
Everybody's pretending, Truman. Get out of here. Come and find me.
Truman?
Truman!
Truman!
Anything happen?
No.
Mm-hmm.
You may find yourself in another part of the world.
Feels like the whole world revolves around me. Everybody seems to be in on it.
I'm going away for a while.
You may tell yourself, this is not my beautiful wife. You may ask yourself, how did I get here?
I'm not in on it, Truman, because the last thing that I would ever do is lie to you.
Fade up music. That's our hero shot.
He's gone.
Find him. Truman, where are you going?
You can do it.
How do we stop him?
Give me some lightning.
Is that the best you can do?
Cut transmission.
I like your pen. I was wondering that myself.
Jim Carrey. The Truman Show. Watch what happens.
Am I Truman?
All right, let's hit some opening thoughts about this feature film. Michael, since you are our special guest, you get to go first. When and where did you see it, and what'd you think?
Yeah, so the first time I saw it, it was summer of 98, and I just graduated from high school, so that should tell my age right there. And
feeling old.
The lo- Yeah.
And you're all really cute. That's cute. High school. Yeah.
And the local theater where I grew up at, Shady Brook Cinemas, that's where I saw it from. Unfortunately, now that theater has been torn down, but that's where growing up, I saw a lot of films. And I was really excited about this one because I was a Jim Carrey fan, especially in the 90s, like a lot of 80s, 90s kids were. Mm-hmm. And so I was super excited to see this film because it looked different from a lot of his films, too. And so went and checked it out and fell in love with it first time I saw it and became one that was in my regular rotation of watching ever since.
Very cool. Very cool. All right, Amber.
So I'm probably going to be different from you guys because a little bit of Jim Carrey usually goes a long way with
me. I 100% agree with that statement.
Oh, good. Okay. Because especially I had two younger brothers, and so it was Ace Ventura and talking out their butts and Fire Marshal Bill like all the time. So I, even Peter Weir could not lure me to this movie in the theater. So I didn't see it till it came out on video. And I think I ended up just watching it because like my parents had rented it and was absolutely, completely, totally blown away. And it's one of my like all time favorite movies.
All right. Very good. Robert.
I also saw it in the theater, not in high school. I think I was edging toward a double digit high school reunion by that point. But anyway, you saw it in the theater, and like Amber and like yourself, I guess, not a Jim Carrey fan at all. But I love Peter Weir's movies. In fact, I mentioned Picnic and Hanging Rock on another episode.
Right.
That's a favorite. So, yeah. So, and the trailer was just so interesting. And I thought, this is either going to be like a train wreck or it's going to be one of the best pictures I've ever seen. And I loved it. But what surprised me was how popular it was, because it's really kind of disturbing and bleak and cynical, and it's not like a feel-good, warm and cuddly movie. It's also not a Jim Carrey, you know, overextending his charm movie, and like Ace Ventura. I was like, who else is loving this? Because this is kind of harsh, but I really liked it, and it seems like it has held on, and it is held up. I watch it every couple of years. I'll pull it out again, and I'll get something new out of it. It's weirdly timely all these years later, even maybe more than when it came out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's surprising. I remember the hype around this movie. I remember hearing, you know, one of the best movies of the year, and it stars Jim Carrey. And I was like, what? So, and like you guys, I was of course aware of Jim Carrey from Living Color, you know, from his movies that I watched and then wished I'd got that 90 minutes back. And, you know, I was like, okay, whatever. But I was a fan of Peter Weir, of course, you know, Dead Poets Society, whatever. So when this was coming, I was very curious. And I was actually able to secure advanced screening passes. So I got to go see it a week prior to its official release. So we lined up outside of a theater that no longer exists, which breaks my heart. And so we were let in. And as you went in, they had kiosks set up for you to take free Truman buttons, which, of course, I still have mine somewhere in one of my many tubs because, of course, I did. And so we go in and we're watching the movie. And, of course, from just the word go, I'm in love with this movie. I'm just having such a good time. It's such a great concept. It's an interesting look at reality TV before reality TV was any definitely not like it is now. So I bought in hook, line, and sinker. I worked at Suncoast at the time, and the only merchandise I could find to buy was a simple t-shirt that just had the cloud wall with the stairs on it. That's all the t-shirt was. And I wore that shirt out to the point to where it started to fall apart. So unfortunately, I don't have that anymore, but I loved the movie, loved, you know, just talking about it and all the questions it brings to mind when you watch it. As Robert said, it's kind of a dark story. And what's funny is that, you know, spoilers maybe, the original screenplay was much darker. So I'm curious about that. It's a quick story about the advanced screening. Now, you know, I was all excited about this, and I love going to advanced screenings because typically when you go, you know, even with, especially with the midnight showings, you're going with like-minded people. You're all there for the same reason. You're either big fans of the franchise or the actor or something or whatever. So we go in, and for the most part, the crowd was well-behaved. You, of course, you had the seats that were reserved for the local press and things like that. So we're walking out, and I'm just like having all the feels because I enjoyed the movie so much. And I overheard a conversation behind me. Now, I know I'm on a slightly different level of movie nerd than many people, and I get that, and I'm fine with that. But when you start listening to a conversation, the person behind you, the two people, the first person says, well, I figured out it was a TV show when it only rained on him. The other one said, well, I figured out when the light fell from the sky. And I'm thinking, it tells you it's a TV show in the friggin' trailer. It tells you at the very beginning of the movie, they introduced the actors. What do you mean you figured it out? It was all I could do not to turn around and go, hi, I'm Earth. Have we met? You know, sorry, another movie reference, but whatever. It was so frustrating. I just kept walking my head down. I was like, no. Anyway, moving on.
I know M. Night Shyamalan wasn't a thing in 98 just yet, but no, you know, twist, yet. The twist is not there. So I don't know what they were thinking at that point.
Yeah. And that's what floored me. I'm like, did you just walk into the theater? I mean, even if they walked in 3 minutes late,
This is why we follow Lin-Manuel Miranda's three block rule. When he goes to see a Broadway show, the rule is you can't say a word about what you just saw for three blocks, because the person that like wrote it or produced it or whatever, like, could be right behind you, or the mom of the lead actor, you don't know, in New York. But Liam and I do that with movies too. Like, if we go out to dinner after, like, mum's the word until we get in the car, because you don't want to say something stupid that somebody else is going to hear. You don't want to spoil it for anybody else.
Right. Right.
I love that three block rule. I'm going to steal that, Amber.
Yeah, I like that too.
My thing lately, in the last few years, theater going has become almost unbearable, because there are people who, during the show, make those kind of dumb observations. Like, I love this song. Or, he's Hamilton. Like, yeah, yes. We all love this song. That's why we're here.
Keep that in your thought bubble.
yeah. But anyway. Something else.
Let's move on.
That's the fact, Jack!
That's the fact, Jack!
It's time for That's the Fact, Jack. These are some production facts about the film and some facts about our director. So, Robert, what do you have for us?
Well, this film had a long birthing, which is probably for the best, the way it all shook out. Andrew Niccol wrote the screenplay originally in 1991, 7 years before the film was released. It was going to be called The Malcolm Show. And as he is known for, because his previous only feature film was Gattaca, and he'd done some since, but a very dark and very sci-fi, futuristic kind of, like, you know, Blade Runner noir kind of thing is what he writes. And what he did write, it was set in New York City, and there were even sequences with, like, fake crime scenes and fake murders that were staged and all these things. It was really kind of bleak. And the themes and the feelings that our new movie, our current movie, reflect, we're not really in that. It was just the concept of one person's life being a TV show. But Scott Rudin loved it. He bought it for Brian De Palma, who fits with the dark and the creepy and the violent. And for this reason and that, they went through many, many directors after De Palma was out. And what's interesting is normally these lists, they're either like hot directors or they're, you know, the ones that are affiliated with the writer or the studio. In this case, like, names that were mentioned and brought in seriously were Terry Gilliam, Tim Burton, Steven Spielberg, several others. But what's weird about this list versus a lot of other, this person could have directed it. I would totally go see the Terry Gilliam Truman Show, and I would go see the Tim Burton Truman Show, and I would see the Steven Spielberg Truman Show. Like, they all of them are a fit for this, which I think speaks to how interesting the concept and script is, that you can layer in the different directors. There were several more as well. Anyway, Peter Weir got the gig. He was coming off of a good run with Year of Living Dangerously and Witness and Dead Poets. He came from being kind of Australian and avant-garde to more mainstream. And unusually, he did not write Witness or Dead Poets Society or Truman Show. And it's interesting that his most, at least commercially successful films are ones he did not write, but he is a writer. He wrote most of his other screenplays, like you know, Living Dangerously and Picnic at Hanging Rock. But anyway, he wanted rewrites, though. I think that writer in him came out. And because they were waiting around for Jim Carrey and trying to find a star, there were lots of rewrites. One source I read said that Nichol did almost 16 rewrites before right. Carrey was cast. They considered Robin Williams at one point because, of course, Weir had worked with him on Dead Poets Society. And they'd also looked at, apparently, Gary Oldman, who, unlike how wow. I think all the directors would fit, I cannot imagine a Gary Oldman Truman Show, at least in the incarnation we have now.
No, because Commissioner Gordon in Christopher Nolan's Batman trilogy is like that guy.
Kind of. I guess it's just hard to peel off, you know, good old Jim Carrey out of Truman and make it be somebody who's... But at any rate, Jim Carrey went for it. He wanted it really bad. The scuttlebutt is that he and Williams were always feuding and comparing each other. I don't know if it's true or not. But the idea is that Williams had scored really well with Dead Poets Society in a dramatic role and broke away from the manic comic energy thing. And Carrey wanted to step away from his Ace Venturas and his other things and be seen as a more of an actor. So he said he'd do it, but it took about 2 years for him to be freed up with his schedule. So they did almost a dozen more rewrites, really tailoring it. And Weir had a big hand in those rewrites. He put in a lot of the information and a lot of the ideas that we see. So even Nichol said it really ended up being more collaborative than just his screenplay outright. So they got Jim Carrey, yay. They filmed it in Seaside, Florida, which is a fantastic location. Peter Weir's wife actually apparently found it. They talked about sets, they thought about building stuff, but they had this perfectly good place sitting right there. Also filmed it partly in the Paramount and Universal backlots out in Los Angeles. My personal story, I didn't yell at Poor Talkers, although I would have as well. But my husband for a little while was doing the flower design for a TV show that was being filmed in Universal. So every Friday morning about 6 a.m., he would go out to Universal Studios and set up all the flowers and get everything ready. And then occasionally I would go with him and we would walk around the Universal backlot and play at Cabot Cove and pose outside the Psycho House and do all the crazy things. But the boat sequence at the end of the film where he drives his boat into the big cyclorama, that was actually at Universal Studios and it was still up for many, many years and it still basically looks the same. It still even had the hole in it and all that. So that was always fun to see. So I actually ran over one time and put my hands in the water. So I have Truman Show water somewhere coursing through me at some little molecule. Anyway, mainly filmed on location in Seaside, Florida. They did some nominal work with some CG, which was new at the time, to extend out some of the buildings and some of the backgrounds. But basically what you saw was at the time, and I guess still is, a real place. The film, when it was released, was nominated for several awards, including 3 Oscars for Best Director and Best Screenplay. And weirdly, for Ed Harris as Kristoff, not for Jim Carrey. But it did not win any, but it got lots of other awards. There was talk of a sequel, which I thought sounded fascinating, and Nichol was going to drag it back to New York City, which I guess he couldn't let go of that idea. But the idea was the sequel was going to be a direct sequel to this one, where they were going to start off with a handful of new children in different neighborhoods of New York City, and there would be a show for each child. So there'd be a kid in Harlem, and a kid on the Upper East Side, and a kid over in the Queens or wherever, and you would follow these different children throughout their lives. And the premise of the movie was, and each would have their own show, a different show, but they would all be happening at the same time. And that by mistake, 2 of the children meet. And so it kind of blows up. And then the plot was going to start really in full force at that point, with what happens when these two reality shows cross over into each other when they've been established. Anyway, I would love to find a copy of that script. I was doing some deep dives and dark web searches and could not find it. But anyway, to tidy up, the film was so successful. In fact, there was a psychiatric syndrome named after it. Yep. As Andrew Nichol himself said, you know you've made it, you have an illness named after you. yet it apparently, since the film's release, there have been multiple cases of people who believe their lives are being filmed. It's not really ever occurred prior to this. So it was paranoia and stuff, but never this idea that your whole life is being faked for you. And there were some fantastic examples. One fellow went to New York City because he thought that the Twin Towers falling on September 11th was just staged for him and that hadn't actually happened. Several other like crazy examples of that. But it is now not only a film we all remember, but it is also a disease you can get if you are inclined to that kind of fancy. And that's kind funny. Of my production notes for that film.
All right. Very good. A few more notes I want to mention real quick. Of course, we mentioned it's written by Andrew Niccol, which didn't do a whole lot after this. He really kind of did, you know, kind of went quiet. And then, of course, Peter Weir still continued doing so, but not too much. I just kind of find it funny with such a great script. And Niccol didn't do a whole lot after this. But anyway, we mentioned Jim Carrey, of course. Laura Linney is in this. Noah Emmerich, a favorite of Michael's. I always ruin her name, but Natasha McHoney, something like that. I can't remember. She's beautiful and I love her, but I cannot remember how to say her damn name. And of course, Ed Harris, Paul Giamatti is in there with no name, but I love him, his part. Music by Philip Glass and Burkhart Dalwitz. It was released June 1st. It premiered June 1st, 1998 in Los Angeles, and of course went wide release June 5th. And runtime of 103 minutes. Budget of $60 million, which actually was $20 million under initial estimates. So that's pretty cool. Box office was $264 million. So quite a success considering the high concept of the movie and the subject matter. So very cool. And yeah, Jim Carrey took a $8 million pay cut. His regular fee at that point was $20 million a movie. He took $12 million just to make sure he got the role. So I thought that was pretty cool too. All right. Amber, tell us about Peter Weir.
So he is, as we said, an Australian filmmaker. He was born on August 21st, 1944, and actually went to University of Sydney, studied arts and law, and has a law degree. After college, he started working in television. He was a production assistant. He directed some. He wrote some. And then he joined the Commonwealth Film Unit and began making documentaries for them. And what I thought was fascinating was they were talking about, you know, everywhere it was talking on the internet, it was talking about he was a leader in Australian New Wave cinema. And I was like, what even is that? Well, come to find out, after World War II, like the film industry in Australia just died. Like they were making nothing until the 60s. And then the government invested in funding film production and training new filmmakers.
Interesting.
And so starting in the 60s, they started building this, you know, genius brain trust of creativity. And between 1970 and 1985, nearly 400 films were produced.
Wow.
And Weir was one of these, you know, young filmmakers that was spearheading this movement along with George Miller, Philip Noyce, and Gillian Armstrong.
Wow.
Like, what a collective.
Right? A lot of talent there.
Wow.
I know, right? So then in 1971, he transitioned over to directing feature films. He made some small films, some independent things. And then 1975, he had his first major breakthrough with the true story. Shut up, Robert. Shut it. Jeez. The fabulous Picnic at Hanging Rock.
I'll give you fabulous. Fabulous for sure.
Stop it. It all happened. Then the 80s,
did the Truman Show. It was real too.
It was. Yeah. It was his whole life.
Yeah.
In the 80s, of course, it was his international success. Yeah, we already mentioned Witness and Dead Poets Society, among others. He's only made 13 films and has officially retired, saying it's hard to find stories that he wants to tell, and he's enjoying going around the world and seeing interesting places and meeting interesting people. And that's what he wants to spend his time doing. He received an honorary Oscar in 2022 and will receive the Golden Lion at this year's Venice Film Festival.
Wow. So I got to admit, I only recently watched Master and Commander for the first time. And God, why did I wait so damn long? That was such a great movie.
I've not seen it either. Oh, it is so good.
It's a really good film.
Yeah.
And it's one of those amazing movies that if you've read any of the books.
Well, I have. That's why I kind of was like, yeah, I don't want the
you
group.
Think, how can they capture this? And you will be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
It was the way it was shot, the fact that, you know, most of that takes place on a ship. And even though there's so many characters, he did a good job making sure you got to know the ones that were important to know. And now it was, oh man, just from the opening in the fog, I'm ashamed I waited so long to watch it. But good news is I got it used at a garage sale for 50 cents. So now it is completely in my collection.
Even better.
No kidding. But man, what a fantastic movie. So very good. All right. Does anybody else have any facts they want to throw out before we move on?
I do want to mention, I love the story that when Jim Carrey and Peter Weir met and were talking about Jim Carrey, you know, taking this role, he mentioned that the scenes in the bathroom and everybody like pretends to have an interview in the bathroom or right. whatever it is that you do. And Jim Carrey just jumped up and was like, well, let's do it.
Right.
And just started riffing like right there in the office. And all of that bathroom stuff is just him.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Those are so fun. Especially, you know, it's like, use me as an alternative source of food. Gross.
Just, yes. Well, and it's so restrained. It's the control yeah. that he has is amazing.
Yeah. And, if you see the teaser, or one of the two trailers, there he actually is a song for Chumania that they sing in the trailer, yes. but doesn't make it to the movie. So I think that's just weird. But anyway, so fun. All right, let's move on.
That was totally wicked.
It's time for That Was Totally Wicked. These are some things we love about the film. I'm going to be honest. I started with one or two, and then I just kept on going and going and going. So I'm going last just to make sure everybody else gets a chance. So, all right, Michael, you're a special guest. Something you love about The Truman Show.
Really, what I love is the cast. We've mentioned some of them already, but, you know, some other ones to highlight, too, is Philip Baker Hall.
Yes.
Very, very great character actor. He is the network executive. He's tremendous. Harry Shearer is the talk show host. You yes. remember that? He was great too. Peter Krause plays right. Truman's boss. And Holland Taylor is Truman's mother. You know, again, another great actor.
Right.
Just the way this cast came together, because you know, you would think, especially at this point with Jim Carrey playing such over the top comedic roles. For him to come in as a, you know, kind of a serious role. I mean, there are definitely lots of funny moments and his timing really kind of shows here in this film.
Right.
But the fact that you have just this emotional roller coaster that he goes through and the cast goes through together. I just think they just did a great job of putting all the right pieces together to make this film what it is. With a great script and a great cast. And for me, that's really what makes a great film for me is when you have those two things that are married together and just show up and show out, as they say.
Right. All right. Very good. All right. Amber.
So putting aside my many, many, many feelings about Meryl that we'll discuss. I just cannot get over Laura Linney in this right. movie. She's
amazing in everything anyway, but yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially I just watched Primal Fear the other day.
Oh, right.
And to
yeah.
see her in that and then turn around and watch her in this. And I mean, and usually I like her, but there is just, I cannot express enough how much I want to rip her into little tiny pieces. And she's horrible. And everything about her is perfect. Her performance is just, it really, you know, Peter Weir talked about the idea for this movie is what would make you want to escape from paradise? And like, she's at the top of the list.
Wow.
But you know, you had to look at, like, there's nothing really wrong with her on the outside.
Right.
And the way she plays those layers and makes me like absolutely hate her with every fiber of my being, while at the same time being like completely cream cheese, banal, like non-offensive, is, I just can't even get over it.
She, I love when she comes down the stairs when he's working in the quote unquote working on the mower. She poses. At first, it's her hands are sort of way, and then she has her hands up like this. She poses for every time she delivers a line. And I did read that apparently she was flipping through old Sears 1950s catalogs,
yes,
for how the model stood, so she could bring that. I mean, that's next level thinking when it comes to that. It's wonderful.
And yes. You took one of mine, Amber, which is good, but I'll pile on then. Lenny's always amazing in everything, and she's so versatile. But in this, I watched this the other day again, another time, just to kind of watch her performance. And it's amazing because there are like at least three layers where you see her as the wife, as Meryl, being just normal and, you know, making breakfast and doing her stuff. And then all of a sudden she turns on Meryl, the spokesperson who's selling the cocoa and selling the lawnmower. And it's microscopic, but it's so obvious at the same time. But it's like, you know, and then there's when accidentally Hannah, the actress, comes out, and especially that wonderful scene where she's panicking and she has that great line about, this is unprofessional, which is like hilarious and blood chilling at the same time, which is right. Why this movie's so great. But she has to Amber's point, so many layers to what she's doing where she's embodying it and she's sending it up and she's showing you the calculating person who's acting the whole thing out on the outside and where the fault lines and the cracks are as things get worse and worse. It is just an amazing performance. I was surprised when I was looking at production information. She really did not get looked at for acting awards. It was all either Ed Harris or Jim Carrey really got the acting nominations. And I think a different actress might not have been able to sell it as well, and right. Wouldn't have had the same film.
Yeah, she has that expression when they go across the bridge and they're, you know, quote unquote, trying to escape. And she's asking, well, what are we gonna do for money? And, you know, I'm gonna have to call your mother and all this other stuff. And then you hear the sirens and you see this, that little bit of relief on her face, you know, like coming up that the road's blocked. And it's just enough that if you're not paying attention, you don't see it. But yeah, she is great. Yes, you love the actress, hate the character. Yes. So it's the best way to put it.
Yes, best way to put it.
Very good.
Well, one of the things I always wondered, especially after like many rewatches, is what exactly was Meryl's end game? Like, what if nothing had happened as far as like Truman going, you know, off the reservation and, you know, wanting to escape and just wanted to live in Seaside, like what would have happened with her? Like, would she have just gotten fed up on her own to leave, or would she have been happy with Truman? Like that's always one of those things I always wondered, like what would have happened with her? Because
I found an interview with Laura Linney and she talks about that. And she says that her actress character, Hannah, was only in it for the money. Mm-hmm. That she made sure she got a cut for every product placement and that this was an acting gig and she wanted all the money. And the theory was if the show had gone on, which of course it doesn't, but in one version, the idea was that she was going to become pregnant and then they were going to have like the baby live on TV.
Well, and, like, I read a thing that she got a bonus every time they had sex.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That she was part of the same interview. Like, there's a scene where she is giving an interview. And she's talking the way that some actors do, where she is just soulless. Like, yeah. Hannah, the person, is horrible. And she is like, she just whores herself out to the show. And she's trying to make it sound like, well, we're all on stage and, you know.
Yeah, but it's so phony. I know. But no, so the idea was with her character, Michael, was that she was going to have this child live on TV. And Christoph even says in the final print. He says, you know, I'm going to be the first one to show live copulation on television.
Right.
But then they're going to have the baby on TV and then have a little, you know, Truman Jr., whatever. But the long game was that at some point their marriage was going to become untenable and they were going to divorce and she was going to get to leave their little town and basically be written out of the show. And then Hannah, the actress, Hannah Gill, would be this wealthy, wealthy, wealthy woman with all this money from all her shrewd pitching she's been doing and all that. So she was just purely in it for the cash. But
right.
Long game was that eventually she was going to take her money and run and, you know, God knows what. But yeah.
All right. So I've lost track. Is it Robert Stern? Yes, Robert Stern.
Well, Amber, do you have any more?
We'll come back around.
Yeah. Dayton. I could just talk about every scene in the movie.
I watched it again today before I was finishing up my notes and I was just going to say, I'm just going to keep it to two. And then I got to three. Then I got to four. Then I got to five. Things. So
my big one, and it kind of umbrellas a bunch of them, is the script and the specificity of the script, both in the writing, the acting, the set design, everything about this movie. Just I think it benefited from taking a while to get together because they had more time to think about it. I mean, in particular. I mean, there's so many great quotable lines and sequences, but there's all these amazing details in the film. Like there are bottles of vitamin D all over the place in their house, which you need to take if you do not get enough sunlight, which I learned when we moved to Ohio.
You do my job, you get plenty of sunlight. That's for sure.
Didn't have that problem in California, moved to Ohio, and now I'm on vitamin D.
Anyway, rickets.
The boat he sails away on is the Santa Maria, which of course is one of Columbus's ships to find the New World. I mean, there's just all these little nuances and things, but so the script is so great. But what I love most about it is the kind of the 1-2 punch of the structure of it,
which
is so intricate. And then the tone and tone. I talk about tone in almost every episode. Tone is so hard to do right, especially when you're doing something really high concept or a scary movie or a comedy. If any part of it is just the wrong tone, it kind of wrecks the film. If there's one actor who's dialed up to 11, it just or one, you know, element. And Weir is so great with tone. That's why Picnic and Hanging Rock, among others of his films, witnesses like that too. But the tone is so great throughout. There's like not a false note. Everything belongs in the same film, in the same world. But the structure of this film is just boggling, where they tell you straight off, it's a TV show, it's all going to be fake. And then they jump in with interviews with the actors before we actually get into the show. Then we get into the show. Then they like rip us back out and are showing us people watching the Truman Show in like the Truman Bar with the merchandise on the back
right,
wall.
Right now, Robert's literally reading my notes. He's really...
Amber stole mine, I'm stealing yours.
I even have times written down, Robert. I got really specific.
And you would think like the obvious way to do this would have been, you know, start the movie, show us a day in the life of Truman, and then at some point, you know, rip the rug out from under us and have the whole audience wet their pants and go, oh my God, it's a TV show. Like you had with your friends in the theater. That could have been a really great way to, I think it would still have worked. It wouldn't have worked as well, but it would have been a great, like, what the hell moment. I mean, think about movies like The Others and some of those where they reverse something on you and it's just stunning. This could have done that, but they just chose to kind of lay it all out. And then, that final sequence, dear God, I don't mean to get into your notes again, but you have this like, you know, is he going to go through the door? Isn't he going to go through the door? We don't know. And the suspense is like jarring, like you're watching a horror movie or a Hitchcock thing or something. And then you have this amazing, when he finally does it, this amazing Philip Glass score that just like rainbows and, you know, unicorns and tinkling sounds and things. And then we immediately slam into the two guys in the garage going, oh, you got another slice, whatever. What else is on? I mean, it was like, boom, boom, boom. And between the suspense of, oh my God,
the jarring when you go into the control room.
Yeah. It just,
and all of a sudden you've been watching everybody makes the show.
So this the structure of this and the way they play scenes off each other and going, and you're never at a loss. You're never like, where am I now? Or what am I seeing? Or like you immediately get a guy in the bathtub. Okay, he's watching the show, rather than what, you know, what are we seeing now? And I said that the whole tone of it was something this intricate, with layers of actors in real life, playing actors in the film, playing characters in this fake world. It's all set up. There's so many ways it could have gone wrong in terms of the acting levels or the understanding of it from an audience point of view, you know, but it was all crystal clear. But the script and structure just were my big umbrella of what was just amazing about this movie and why it's worth rewatching over and over. So did I leave you any crumbs, Dayton?
You did. I want to touch on, because you mentioned the score, the two pieces of music I want to mention specifically, the piece of music where Truman is wandering through the square when he's kind of starting to have that realization, because it's a little cheery and it's also a little like it's inquisitive. You know, it kind of purposely or perfectly follows his mood and his tone as he wanders around. I love that piece of music. And then the music, what I call the danger music, which we get when he's trying to escape at the power plant. And then of course later when he's on the boat and the storm. And then of course it's actually the music they play during the closing credits. So I love all that music. Just, I love it. And Philip Glass appears in the movie. He's actually playing the piano while Truman is asleep. And Christoph is being creepy and petting him on the screen. Anyway. So, okay. Now to your point about details, the details in this movie are next level brilliant. Okay. Aside from the headlines, like, you know, the one, like the best place in the world to live, which is funny. Then he's at the newsstand and the newspaper he buys, the guy's reading it behind him, says, "Who needs Europe?" You know, and just like, okay, funny. And all the stuff in the travel agency, you know, things to look out for when you're traveling, you know, like disease and mobs and all that other stuff, and the lightning bolt going through the plane, just all that kind of great stuff. But the t-shirts that the security guards are wearing says, "Love him, protect him," which is great. But
yeah.
The music, the TV shows, so everything's there to keep him calm, whatever. But what I absolutely love are the magazines that are available to buy at the newsstand. You have stuff like Dog Fancy and Child, Modern Dad, Country Living, everything to instill small town life and driving
suburbia. Yeah.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Just because it's one of those things that if you're not paying attention, you don't see, but you hear the lady buys Dog Fancy all the time and whatever. So the planning, and to your point about the structure, part of me wonders if the structure was more screenplay or more Peter Weir changing the structure to fit, because as I mentioned, I have times. So the first, we get to, of course, get the opening with the actors, you know, this is a Truman Show, whatever. So then it's 14 minutes of film when we first see our parking attendants. You know, they never show anything. You know, they go to the curtain and then the wind blows, you know, play some music. You never actually see anything. And then you go back to the movie. It's great. So, and then 20 minutes after, we get the Truman Bar, which bookends the Sylvia flashback, which is fantastic. Okay. Now, the bar again at 45 minutes. And then we, when we truly come back to the real world at 57 minutes with the control room. So we're an hour into this movie before we go back to Christoph and the control room. And that's when you realize that he's feeding lines to Marlon at the scene where his dad shows up. So it's great. And then from that point, you're over halfway through the movie. So from that point, you pretty much go back and forth from Truman's world to the real world. So he gave us time to get comfortable in Truman's life. And then just remind you, no, wait a minute, it's a show. And then takes you back into Truman's world for a while. Then remind you, just remember, it's still a show, you know? And so because to me, when you see when you go to the control room, it wasn't jarring. I was kind of waiting for it, because like, you're like, at some point, Weir's taking us back there. And, you know, but the way they did it was the best reveal, that you realize how much control Christoph has over this world he's created, which is awesome and disturbing and sick all at the same time. So there. I piggybacked on yours. Did anybody else notice that everybody was wearing booties on their shoes except for Christoph? I thought that was strange and weird.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking he's trying not to get sick, but whatever. And a quick side note on the guy that runs the newsstand. What a jerk. What an absolute jerk this guy is. And let me tell you, because he's like, you know, he buys the fashion magazines for the wife. I know you're lying. I know you're lying. And I'm saying it because I know. And I'm like, you're a jerk. You're a little jerk. You know? So, whatever.
Well, no, in that same area, I love the two guys who corner him in front of the ever-changing billboard.
the twin brothers.
Yeah. And it's great because the first time it's like, oh, this is weird. And we're going kind of into like David Lynch territory now with weird twins and this like everything too shiny business. But then... So the first time you see the billboard, but then they revisit that, and you see the little fisheye lens, and you even see Truman kind of like, what is like, oh, the billboard is different behind me now. and it was just, that was so great. But yeah, I love Dog Fancy. Every shot, there was like Dog Fancy.
Well,
yeah.
And it
was new issues all the time.
Yes. Yeah.
Similarly, all of those little extras, they were making every second count for their little piece of fame.
Right.
Like the guy that sells him the ferry ticket, he's like leaning out the window so he could stay in the shot. Well,
how about the cops are bringing back after the power plant issue? Like she's thanking him and everything, and they're like taking a peek in. Like the one guy's looking, is like, I'm trying to get a glimpse of Truman. I want to see in his house. And I'm like, because they're actors, and that's what they would do because they want that moment of fame. And the little girl on the bus, hey mom, isn't that so and so? And it's great. I mean, just the things they do in there, it's fantastic filmmaking. So anyway.
Yeah. Speaking of that, the when they are doing their getaway and the security guard accidentally, or cop, whatever he is, accidentally calls him Truman.
Yeah,
wow.
You're welcome, Truman.
Yeah. what a great like stinger moment that was too. There's a couple of those in the movie, and that was just
Well, you see his face, and then you look over at Meryl, and she's like, oh crap, did he hear that? There's that look of terror on her face when she realizes what he said. Oh, so good. So good.
A little wink to the Great Escape there.
Right? Right? Yeah. All right. Michael, do you have anything else you want to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to add about the cinematography. I thought that was one of the highlights too of the film, because you have so many different kinds of shots. You have actually like the overarching shots of the town. You have, you know, as we mentioned, about the dome area where Christoph and all them are in the office working. You have out in real world, you have those shots. And then you have like the fisheye lens, you know, trying to capture Truman in all the different places. And the way that they married all of them together to, you know, make it seem seamless is
right.
I thought just very well done. And I definitely, that was one thing I want to make sure to say, that was something I loved and shouted that out.
Yeah, there were some great angle choices when he's on a sailboat, you know, underwater and stuff like that, and from the mast. So they did a good job of it going back and forth from what you assume is one of the cameras for the show, and also an actual camera that we're seeing. So they made sure to have the fisheye lens from time to time and to remind you, oh, this is one of the cameras. So
They did the vignetting a lot, where we had the little slight rounding in the corners where it wasn't a true fisheye, where it was distorted, but it had that little rounding. And it was interesting, on one of the bonus features, which is why you should get the Blu-ray or the DVD, because you get bonus features.
My DVD has no bonus features except for trailers. So I need to upgrade mine.
Oh, no, there's some awesome ones. I want to upgrade to Blu-ray because there's more now. But anyway, on one of the bonus features on the DVD I have from whenever it came out, they talk about some of the film was put together in the editing, in particular the sailboat scene and some of those things, where Weir had a pretty good idea what he wanted to shoot, but they shot tons of footage. They shot almost enough for like a second movie. because he wanted to be able to cut things together and make scenes. And so they had to go through, and in some of the scenes, by the time they were actually finished after they were filmed, they added in digitally the vignettes, and other times they removed them depending on how we were supposed to be seeing this. And which I thought was interesting. And what they deleted most of, and it's why I want to get the Blu-ray, because apparently there's more of it out there. There's almost an hour film's worth of Laura Linney as actress Hannah, and all of them like a behind the scenes. They were going to release a behind the scenes making of the Truman Show special that was in world. So it wouldn't be Laura Linney talking about that show. It would be her character and everybody else's characters. But so they filmed a ton of it. And those first few minutes at the beginning where we talked to the best friend and we talked to his wife are, I think, the only two that made it into the final film.
Yeah.
there's a ton of it out there, and it's on one of the releases. So I need to find that.
There's apparently a deleted scene where Marlon, when at the end of the movie, when Truman's trying to escape to the sailboat, there's apparently a scene where Marlon finds him and then lets him go, because he actually did become, he really did care about Truman.
Yeah.
And it was really considered him a friend. And so, yeah, I need to upgrade. And actually on Amazon, I was searching through the Blu-ray, and it's not so easy to find as what I was. So I'm a little upset. So I'm going to have to either cough up a lot of money, because the versions I kept seeing were from Europe. I'm like, I'm not trusting that.
Anyway. Yeah. There was an interesting thing about Marlon too. They referenced in one of the bonus features I did see was that they all had these very elaborate character arcs and backstories for their actor characters. And his apparently, his character, not Marlon, but the actor, was having drug issues, drug trouble, as so many child stars do, because he started off as a child star and then he started feeling guilty because he was actually liked Truman. Like, they grew up together as boys and he liked him and he did not want to betray him and sell him out. So he started taking drugs. And so in the film, the final print, there is a reference to him saying, oh, remember that time I was gone a month for, I forget why he says he was gone,
but he had sick. Pneumonia.
Yeah, he was sick.
He had pneumonia. Yeah. That was when the actor was actually in rehab and could not be on the show. And so they all had these really, yeah. So Louis, the actor, had to be in rehab. So Marlon was not able to be there. And so there's still remnants of these interesting backstories and these extended scenes that did not make the cut. But I kind of like it, because even the way that one played, he's like, oh, remember that time I wasn't here for a while? You're like, well, you're thinking, oh, well, because he in real life, was getting married, or he was, right, you know, whatever. So it still worked. It wasn't like a jarring, like, what does that mean? But yeah, this film had a lot of rich things that never made it on the final print, which...
Yeah, I'm trying to find. I'm on Amazon right now, trying to find the Truman Show Blu-ray. I'll be right back.
Right. And we'll take a station break right now. Okay?
Well, I think they released a new version of it with the 25th anniversary being last year.
Yeah, I think so too. But yeah, like I said, the ones it ranges in price from $20 to $50 to $31. So I'm gonna have to do some research and find out which one's legit. So anyway,
yeah, see what's really on it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So any other things we want to say good before we move on?
Yeah, I want to just touch on Paul Giamatti's character.
Yes.
And like the subtlety with which he starts out and he's completely invested in his job. And then as the story progresses and Truman is pushing more and more to break free, he just... like the scales come off and he just becomes completely disillusioned and disgusted. You know, at first it's kind of like he doesn't give a crap. And then it progresses to, you know, him actively subverting.
Yeah.
You know, what Christoph wants. And I just thought that was really, really good from little baby Paul Giamatti. He's so young in this.
Oh, gosh. Yes. I when I did my rescreen episode on The Truman Show, I mentioned specifically how young he looks in this film. I was like, wow, he looks so young because.
And yet exactly the same.
Right.
Right. Yeah, the thing is that, you know, a lot, especially a lot of these later films that he's done, you know, he's kind of become more well known for. It's like, you know, going back and then seeing this one and seeing how young he is. It was just kind of shocking to me.
He had a pretty good year that year. He was on, of course, he was in Dr. Doolittle, Saving Private Ryan, and The Negotiator, all in the same year. So that's a pretty decent year there. So,
and I remember when this film came out that I did not know really of any of these actors, like Holland Taylor and Giamatti and a lot of them. I knew Ed Harris, and I knew, of course, Jim Carrey by reputation. But I think it worked to its advantage kind of back in the day, because so many of these people, a second or third big film role.
Right.
Even Roland Emmerich had done, I think, a couple things and some TV. Peter Krause, I don't know, had done much of anything yet. He was well away from his, you know, TV shows and success. So I think it gave a nice quality, too, to where you could see why Truman would be the star of the show, because right. Jim Carrey has this sort of star charisma, and all these other hardworking actors, you did not know them or have baggage with them. So they were just the people.
Right. Well, and even Ed Harris is completely like moving into his villain era.
Yeah. Yes, he is.
You know, where you had never seen him be anything other than, you know, like John Glenn. I mean, he was like the good, you know, good husband and, you know, good stand-up guy, you know, and then you're not this person. What happened to your soul? Oh my God.
All right. Very good. Anything else before we move on? All right.
No, sir. I didn't like it.
It's time for No, Sir, I Didn't Like It. These are things that either don't work or we don't like in the film. I'll be honest, I have a very, very short list. Michael, you get to go first.
There's really only one thing that I didn't like about this film, and it's the ending. And I say this only with this one caveat. Like, the ending up to a point is perfect.
Okay.
And then I don't like it. And what I love is we see the scene with Truman. He has the moment with Christoph, you know, and he says, you know, he says goodbye. He goes through the door and it shuts. And to me, that's when the movie should have ended. I feel like that would have been the perfect ending. But then we get the follow-up scenes with the people in the real world. And it just, to me, it felt like it just kind of took away from the moment. Because it should have just ended with him leaving. And, you know, because we had been with Truman the majority of the film as, you know, kind of seeing where his journey was. And we saw the journey end. And it should have just been, there he goes. We don't know where he's going. And that's how it should have ended. And so for me, that's really the only thing I didn't like, especially having rewatched it a bunch of times. It just feels like that ending where he walks out and leaves and the door shuts. That should have been it. That should have been the ending. We could have went on home and it would have been perfect, instead of having like the last parts with the people. Oh, what are we going to watch now? Like, that just, to me, I don't know.
I love that. Sorry. But no, this
is going to say, well, you're wrong. So welcome to the list of being wrong.
Sorry, Mike. It was nice to meet you. We will be working together again.
No, what's so funny about this is when Michael's on for Miracle, we also disagreed on that ending. Whereas I thought, you know, it should have ended, you know, earlier. And he was like, well, no, we need all this other stuff there. And then so I find it incredibly amusing. We're like the exact opposite size on this particular thing. So
for me, it would have undercut what the entire movie was really about if you had just left it with him going through the door. I mean, for one thing, it would have been inconclusive and kind of not. But the whole movie was so, like I said at the top of the show, kind of so bleak and satiric and really critical of commercialism and vapid entertainment and, you know, mindless consumerism and all these things that we see over and over. You know, buy some cocoa. Okay. Anyway, you know, and so that ending where the people have invented 30 years and then it's over and then they're like, meh, what else is on? I thought that was genius.
I would have stood
up and cheered if I had, you know, had a chance to. It was just that's the right ending for what we saw.
I do. I understand how y'all are seeing this ending, and I definitely appreciate it. But I just, for me, I just think that would have been a great way to end it.
See, the sequel I want is what happens now, because he goes out, and because you got to know it's going to take, you know, it's going to take Sylvia a little while to get there. You know, if she doesn't live like right, you know, right. So what happens to him when he hits the street? You know, what happens?
Oh, he's going to be knifed in like 5 minutes or run down by a car or something, because he's been cosseted in this little bubble for his entire life. And as soon as he tried to drive a car on a Southern California freeway or, you know, walk out of a store without paying for something, he's going to get shot. You know, your sequel lasts 5 minutes long. And then
I don't think so, but either way, I still think the ending is happy. And it's also kind of when the realization sinks in that yeah, how does this go for him now that he's left? You know what I mean? It's not, you know, the grass isn't always greener, and that's a situation where he might be happy. You know, at least he has a choice, but either way, it's still an interesting ending.
Well, and I think too, sometimes it's good just to have one film be standalone. And,
oh, I agree.
And have it be open-ended. So it's like people could just think on their own as to what happens to Truman, and everyone can have their own ideas, and they're not wrong. Like they can think Truman went and did this or Truman went to do that. And that's okay to have that. And so I think that's why it's fine as it's just a standalone film. Yeah. There is no sequel. There's anything.
Well, and
like
I think that's why it did the huge box office it did, is because on one level and in one way of viewing, yay, happy ending, Truman escapes. Yay. That was worth my $5 and my popcorn, you know, because it's like you got your happy ending. And if that's kind of the narrative or the theme you want to follow. But to me, I saw this, like I said, much more as a kind of a criticism of a lot of things.
Yeah.
And more so as time has gone on and more of it's come true, where we have like a reality show president, for instance, you know, you know, whatever. I won't go into that diatribe. But anyway, the short version is, I think that's why the movie did so well, though. There's lots of people like you, Mikey, who were invested in Truman and saw that as, yay, it's a happy ending. The movie done. He escaped. Victory, you know. But I looked at it a different way.
Yeah. See, I look at it. It depends on the mood, how I am when I watch it. Seriously. Because it could either be a happy ending, like, yay, he got out. Or am I going, yep, that's real. That's true. They would totally do that. You know, the whole, like, I believe, you know, yeah, it depends on what kind of mood I'm in, the story I get. So anyway. All right. Robert, anything that doesn't work for you?
Hardly anything. Although the character of Sybil is a little problematic, beautiful as she is. They have that one brief, you know, week or afternoon or weekend or whatever it is. It's a short time. And then apparently she spent the rest of her life pining away for him, and to where she's almost got like the serial killer thing with like the clippings and the obsessive and all that. I liked that we saw somebody from this show on the outside. Now, I like the idea of her character, but I think they went maybe a little bit too far with her being not just like interested, but like probably not bathing, just sitting in front of the TV screen going, come on, Truman, 24 hours a day. And I would have dialed her reaction back a little bit, maybe made her not be quite so obsessive, just interested.
Well, you know, I was disappointed that I wanted to see her be like Anna to the Infinite Power, where the teacher is trying to subvert it from the inside. Because she was the original clone and she knows all the tricks.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I wanted more of her in the show, just kind of subtly trying to manipulate the storyline, not to benefit, you know, her need to be an actress or her need to be on TV, but to guide him toward freedom.
To your point, that's a great idea. Is that the way it is now, you could almost eliminate her character and her scenes and not have that different a movie, except that she's the one kind of token along with Fiji, but that's also from her. One kind of token of him wanting more or questioning his life, like we all do. So she's emblematic of that, but their scenes are so brief, to your point, when she doesn't get a lot of arc on the show, that maybe that's partly what I'm seeing too, where I just feel like she's just not as heavily weighted as everything else is in the film.
I think she got on the show for that reason. I think with Amber is right that she was trying to subvert it, but she was doing too good of a job that they kicked her out. You know, she got his attention in a hurry and then she got removed. And so I never pictured her being the kind of person that doesn't bathe. I mean, anything, the one dude sitting in his bathtub all the time was more creepy than her.
Well, you know, watching, yes. Yeah.
But
again, why I don't like the ending.
Oh,
stop. But See, I never thought of her. I would have, trust me, I would like to have had more of her character. But yeah, I could see the bad part about her character is we didn't get enough of her character. So
yeah,
all right. Yeah. That's fair. All right, Amber.
All right. I have two.
All right. Well, that's, yeah, I have kind of two. So,
so, and they kind of, I don't know, they're a little connected. Like I already said, I have such issues with Meryl. Like, and I think it's interesting that Robert said you would get this behind the scenes of the cast. You know, the show within the show within the show. Mm-hmm. Because, like, at first you feel like you kind of know who she is, this actress who's very vapid, and she says these, you know, talking points that all actors without any real depth say, and, you know, and she's just in it for the money and everything. But then when you start thinking about it and how manipulated she is, and she never leaves him alone, and she just is like this Stepford being that smiles all the time. And then, like, the added layer of, like, you married this person, and yeah, like, she crossed her fingers, but whatever. Like, how far are you willing to go? Like, how much of yourself are you willing to sell? And, you know, the whole, like, concept, her saying, I thought we were going to try for a baby, makes me want to, like, throw up.
But that's literally the whole point of this show, is they're trying to give him a real life. So that's,
I know,
that's,
but it's just disgusting. It's,
oh, not, I didn't, like, say it was okay.
They could allow him to, you know, like, even if Sylvie, we'll say she wasn't trying to be subversive, if that was the person he chose and really loved, and it was just a person he met, like, they won't let him have that.
Right.
You know, well, presumably, and it just,
because maybe she's not as good an actress, or maybe she didn't sign the same contract that Meryl did.
Yeah,
or,
but it's, or just Hannah did.
Well, it is horrible. That's why it's awful.
And then that kind of leads into the second thing, which is, like, I have a really hard time with the trauma they inflict on him to keep him on this island. Like, the trauma of his father drowning in front of him, and just the cavalier way that they treat that. And I mean, Holland Taylor's hilarious when she's like, you know, of course I don't blame you, while she's totally blaming him. You know? But it just turns my stomach, like, the way they broke this person and all these beautiful qualities that he has from a very young age. You see him wanting to go over the hill and wanting to see what's there and wanting to, everything about him is wanting to get out and explore and, you know, see the world and be more. And the way that they just traumatized him into this box, like, it's just, and it's such a lie. Like, everything they say that they're doing with this show is horseshit.
Well, and that is the point.
That's though, literally why
it's, I know, so, it's upsetting.
Okay, well, that's fair. It is upsetting.
I
but
don't,
yes,
like,
yes,
it.
If you take all that out, then there's no movie.
Show
got
movie.
It.
You just don't want it to be not a TV show. You just want it to be about a real guy. And just, yeah, okay.
No, I just want it to be about him, like, you know, discovering that it's a show and breaking free. Like, those are the parts that I like. The parts where they, you know, that whole flashback when his kills me.
And yeah, it's funny because not to harken back to Unpleasantville.
No, but, I was going to bring it up though, because it, like, they're living in the 50s. Like, that was so great then.
But what I liked about this movie vis-a-vis the one that will not be named is that in this one, although it is pushing the boundaries of reality a little bit, but it is deliberate and everything, it is intentional. And so the trauma, like, they had to traumatize him to get him to want to leave. Like, in a regular, if you were watching this movie and Anna killed dad, you'd be like, why didn't he just leave? Well, in this movie, there's a reason for everything, even if it is an unpleasant reason or kind of a horrifying, nauseating reason, but he'd been conditioned to like this because they need to keep him there.
But then why tell him that he lives on the earth? Why not just tell him this is what all of existence is.
Well, they could have, but the idea is I don't think it would have had an audience. You forget, the whole thing is it was constructed to be a reality show. And of course, remember, the one line, there's a bunch of throwaway lines, but one of the ones that's so chilling is, oh yeah, there were five babies in line to be it, and he got born on the right day, so that's why it's him.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, mm-hmm. How diminishing is that from his birth? The only reason he's the one trapped in this bubble.
He was early.
He was the baby that was born on the day they wanted to start filming, not the four spare kids who God knows what happened to them. And then they also make the point, Christoph does, which again, it's just like this kind of throwaway line, but I watched this movie with a very cynical pair of glasses on, I guess. But Christoph says, oh, well, everything on this you see in the TV show is for sale. You know, the artwork and the furniture and the products, even
their
houses.
Clothes.
We're making millions of dollars. And it's like, so when you start thinking about this is all just done for greed, corporate greed and money, they also throw away the line, which, again, it's funny in context, but when you watch the movie enough times, I find it really kind of like some of it kind of chilling and horrible because it's so heartless and mean. But they say, oh, when you know, he was the first child ever adopted by a corporation. So, I mean, how is Truman doing for money? Well, I presume if Christoph drops dead or the show goes off the air, he'll have millions, you know, waiting for him on the outside, because he is the son of Truman Inc. or whatever the corporate name is.
All right. So, like I said, I just have a few minor things I want to share. So, with a runtime of barely an hour and 40 minutes, I kind of wish we'd have had a couple more scenes for him to completely turn. And getting to that, it's like I said, these are minor, and I understand this is all done on purpose because Christoph controls the whole world. But what bothers me is there's people that are supposed to interact with him, and then the other people that are not literally don't do anything when he does something out of the ordinary. And I know that's even, they've even referenced that as like, you know, they're, you know, when I do something different, they just whatever. But even still, when he's chasing his dad, he's running in front of people. He runs into people. He almost gets hit by a car. There's two cops walking past him. Nobody reacts. Nobody says, hey, get out of the way. And I mean, that's what people do. And he might not completely know that, but it's kind of common sense if you're running into people that somebody says something. He smacks that worker in the butt with his briefcase on a ladder and he doesn't do anything. I'm like, so literally by Christoph controlling it so much and not letting them react basically pushes him, you know, away further. It gives him more clues because at some point you need to say, well, these people need to react a little bit. It's a little too silly. And like I said, I know it's on purpose because he doesn't want any of the extras to slip. Fine. But it just seemed a little strange. And you know, like I said, I know it's on purpose.
They do mention the one part where he says, and somebody ran in front of me and somebody, a lady with a dog came. I forget what the exact quote is, but a few people do things. But yeah, I almost was watching on one of the watchings. And there are almost like foreground people who speak and who are like involved in this. And then there's like background people who almost are like, he says, like now
they're on a loop.
They're
on a loop.
The extras and there's like the bit players. And I think the extras are a lot of times the ones who are just like, holy crap, what do we do? Like, I didn't get pages for this. You know, I don't know what to do. But
with that going into it, I kind of feel like his turn, even though he's, you know, it's been 30 years, whatever, and he's had other things happen, I kind of feel like his turn is very sudden. You know, he has these suspicions. He has itchy feet, as he describes it. He wants to leave. He wants to go to Fiji. He wants to see these things. And he literally goes from cruising at like 25 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour in literally in one night. You know, the whole thing with his you know, his dad comes back, and then the whole thing with Meryl, and it's just all of a sudden now he's willing to risk his life by getting on a boat and sailing God knows where. I kind of feel like there could have been a couple more scenes to reinforce his conspiracy theories or something.
Well, see, I mentioned before the scene where the twins come up about the insurance policy and push him up against the billboard.
Right.
The second time they do that, he looks at it with this weird expression.
I know. Like, yeah. I think he's figured it out, but still.
But that's early in the picture, and I think the first time
it's Kaiser Chicken's, and then the one time where he plays it off like every day, and they accept the policy, and you can kind of see, he goes like, "Let's go right now." No, next week could be better. Yeah. He's making that face like he knows, like these people are playing parts. But my point is, he just, because he even says that morning, that one was for free, and he winks at the mirror when he does the Trumania thing. So he's turned, but it seems like it went from, I have this feeling, to I'm going to take a chance and I don't care what happened. It felt quick to me. And then of course, how does he dig that hole through the ground so quickly in that closet? You know, when did that happen?
Hole, I don't know about that one. The hole, I got nothing on the hole. Between seeing the dad the first time and then finally escaping, I feel like that's days, not like hours. I feel like
it feels like a couple of days because but to me, it still seems quick. It still seems quick to me. But like I said,
the movie starts with the very first scene he's in. Practically, we have the light falling out of the sky, though.
I know,
and then we have the radio with the weird interference where he's hearing the control. I mean,
it just seems like a lot in a very short amount of time. Is my complaint? I guess I don't know, but it's a minor complaint. Like I said, I don't really. I guess I just would like to have more, you know, maybe we get more Sylvia trying to get him, you know, wake him up some more or something, just that something a little work. Bit more, you know, that's like I said, more Sylvia is better. So a few more scenes with her would have been nice. So it's like I said, it's a very quick movie and I wouldn't have hated it being 10 minutes longer, I guess is all I'm saying. So that's pretty much, and he practically drowned in a massive storm. And when he gets to the door, he's completely dry. Just saying, you know, that sweater alone would have been wet for days and a half.
When the hole goes through the spar of the ship, goes through the backdrop too.
Yeah.
Like his hair is dry and like some of it, like the sails are wet, but he's dry. There's continuity.
The hair didn't bother me because it's really short, but that sweater would have weighed 20 pounds. That's all I'm saying. Just that's it. Like I said, nitpicky little things because I love this movie. So, all right. Did I get everybody? Anybody else have any complaints? Didn't think so. Okay. We're going to take a quick promo break. And when we get back, we're going to hit some favorites and give this film a rating.
If you like fun, then you're going to love the Beard Al podcast. It's a podcast where we talk about two of the greatest things in the world, beer and Weird Al. And frankly, we talk more about Weird Al than anything because he's the gift that keeps on giving. So join us as we talk through Weird Al's career, what he means to us, and we have some very special guests on to discuss the magic that is Alfred Matthew Yankovic. Beard Al, part of the Odd Pods Media Network.
Welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast.
I'm Bill.
And I'm Jason. And this is the podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. So whether you're a brain, a jock, a valley girl, or a Jedi, we've got some 80s classics for you.
Do these movies stand the test of time? Are we discovering something new? Is there an 80s movie we are finally watching for the first time?
Join us each week as we dive into the cinematic nostalgia that inspired and influenced a generation. From the hits to the cult classics, we'll discuss our earliest memories, favorite scenes, fun facts, and our not-so-favorite movie moments, too.
You can find the All 80s Movies Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. Please subscribe and happy listening.
Why are you smiling like that?
I just like to smile. Smiling's my favorite.
Make work your favorite. That's your favorite, okay?
Okay.
Work is your new favorite.
Fine.
All right. It's time for Smiling's My Favorite. These are some favorite things about our film. So let's start off. Michael, your favorite scene.
My favorite scene, and it's one that I have a very sentimental attachment to it. It's the scene where Truman is sitting in the car and Meryl comes out to the car and is wondering why he hasn't left yet because he's just sitting there in the car. And Truman tells her to get in, and she gets in the car, and he points at the mirror, the back mirror, and says, "Now look, there's going to be a person walking a dog, there's going to be a person taking out the trash, and then there's going to be a Volkswagen bug that drives by.
The dented beetle.
The dented beetle. And it happens on clockwork." And Meryl's like, what are you? You're just delusional, blah, 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 blah. And so there goes the person riding the bike. And then there's the person taking out the trash. And then there's a beat of waiting. And then Meryl's like, what's going on? And then all of a sudden the bug goes by and Truman goes, there it is. There's that David Beetle. And that is my that's my favorite scene, and partly why the sentimental value is because when I was in college and would watch this film all the time, me and my best friend and my roommate at the time, we would quote that line all the time, especially anytime we saw a Volkswagen bug, whether it was on campus or off campus, whether there was a dent on it or not a dent on it. That's why we would always quote that line.
And it I just love was, it.
It's just one that always has good sentimental value to me.
Oh, that's very good. There's the dented beetle. Oh, sorry. Yes. I love it. I don't, they're on a loop. They go back. They come around again. Sorry. Okay. Robert, favorite scene.
I don't have one favorite scene. What I like is just the way each scene plays off each other. I couldn't pick one because I just, as I mentioned, the structure, just the bouncing back and forth from the different Truman Show realities to the exterior scene to the control. I just the way the scenes played off each other, I just think made every scene better than it was. So it was hard to pick just one favorite scene.
All right. Fair answer. All right. Amber?
From the moment he gets on the boat
to the end.
All the way to the
much,
end.
Pretty much.
I am like at the edge of my seat and crying through the whole thing every time I watch the movie. I love his catchphrase. And when he takes his bow, like, yep. I'm so proud of him. And he goes through the door. And I love the, and here's why Mike is wrong. I love the way we go from our viewers being completely obsessed with this show. They have the merch and they fall asleep watching it and they've got the greatest hits tape and all this stuff, to they're cynically taking bets, you know, like I got 20 says he dies,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. 2-1 says he doesn't make it.
Yeah. And it's horrible.
But and they all cheer when he makes it. They all, well, every single one of them.
They're all holding their breath.
Yeah.
Before he could, what is he going to say? What's he going to do? You know? And then when he goes through the door and they all start cheering and they're so happy for him. And then, you know, just the inevitability of humans, you know, and then it's over and it's like, well,
what else?
Who's got the TV guide?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. That whole section is just
so much happens. I mean, it's such a roller coaster because it starts off all nice and sweet. Oh, there's our hero shot. And now we're going to try and drown him. You know, he literally says, yes. You know, you can't let him die on TV. He goes, well, he was born on TV. So, you know, why not? What's the big problem here?
Okay, you have, so
and the restraint that Ed Harris has to be like insane and he's going to kill him and more and then, wind. And but he's not like foaming at the mouth either.
No, well, there's that moment like when he does capsize and there's that moment, that look on his face like, oh my God, I might have killed him. And there's that, he's like that terrible father that actually does love his kid. He does all the wrong things and then has that moment like, but I do love that little snot, you know? And so, you know, and then you have Paul Giamatti basically fighting back like, no, he's going to die. He doesn't even care. He's like, and so there's so much going on. And, but at the beginning of that, when he pulls out that compiled image of Sylvie out of his pocket, that's where the emotions start for me. And then it go all the way to the end of that movie, just because it's in the look on her face and just like, oh my God. Cause you know, just like him, I get lost in her eyes too. So anyway, All right. So there, good. You took that one. So I'm going to cheat the Sylvia flashback because that whole section is wonderful. But the scene I love so much is when Truman, his little walk around the whole, the square, when he's starting to have that moment, that music plays and he's like, he goes through the revolving door.
That was the other one I was going to pick.
Yeah, yeah. He goes through the revolving door a couple of times. He's just wandering around. He sits down. He's watching the people.
He stops the traffic.
Yeah. And then he's like, does the hand thing. And I'm just like, just him kind of just coming off at the seams and just panicking. And oh, it's so good. I everything about that
section. And the music is yes, perfect.
So good. So wonderful. Love it. All right. Moving on, favorite character, Michael.
Oh, I always loved Truman.
Yeah.
To me, I always felt like I identified with Truman, and I think that's why I just always rooted for him. And I think that's why I don't take the cynical approach to this film.
Right.
And so for me, Truman is probably my favorite character, with a close second being Lewis.
I was going to say, come on now. I was waiting for him to be your choice, honestly.
Well, man. I mean, it's like 1A and 1B.
Right.
I mean,
you know, he might have had a drug problem, but man, did he drink a lot of beer. Anyway, okay.
Always with the label and
that's right.
The camera.
Yes. Which was wonderful. All right, Robert, favorite character?
Oh, Team Meryl / Hannah / Laura Linney. The whole way. Not because
that
I like
soul
her.
Soul is harping.
Well, not because I like her as a person, but the energy and complexity she brought. A lot of the other characters, especially the other ones in the world, were kind of one-dimensional, except for maybe her and Truman and the friend, Marlon. And everybody else was deliberately cartoony. But because we spent more time with her, again, just watching the actress and the real actress all shifting through the different modes from time to time, as Dayton said, I mean, even her posture would change as soon as she was going to start one of her pitches.
Yep.
The cocoa scene is just genius. I love when Truman is like, who are you talking to? another point where the scales are kind of falling off his eyes, but she's not doing it as well at that point because she's panicky. So she's not quite on her A game. So she is being a little bit too much, you know? But so I just, every time she comes on the screen, I am just obsessed with everything she's doing. She's so interesting to me. So don't like her. She's a despicable human being, but my gosh, she is mesmerizing to watch.
All right. Very good. Amber.
Truman. He's such a truly like nice person.
Right.
You know, and even when he's like breaking down and he's frustrated and he knows that these people are lying to him, you know, and even, you know, sort of railing against, you know, the creator and all of it is still, he's still a good person. He's still kind. He's still nice. He's still, you know, just wants to break out. And
yeah,
I just, oh, I love him. He's wonderful.
All right. So since we had two votes for Truman and one for Meryl, I do want to say Marlon, because he actually is a good friend. I mean, yeah, he is on one level lying to Truman, but at the same time, you know, he comes across as a nice guy and as a good friend and whatever. So I do like him, but I want to call out Chloe in the control room because she was kind of, you know, along with Paul Giamatti, they were kind of like the moral compass inside that room. And, yes. You know, and I do like her, a good year for her too. So her name is Una Damon. She appeared in three films that year. She was in this one, of course, Deep Rising and Deep Impact, which is another film we're covering in just a couple weeks. So that's a pretty good year, you know, three big films in one year. But she was, you know, I liked her character. I liked her energy. And
I think she was the first one to push back against Christoph too. Like
there's no safety boat or out. He won't know what to do. And she's like, and he's like, oh, he'll turn back, you know? So yeah, she was one of the first ones to say something. So yeah. So yeah. Chloe. All right. So this is one I added kind of late. Favorite viewer or viewers that are watching The Truman Show. So, Michael.
I have to go with the bar crew. I just think it's so funny, and yet it's so interesting how you have all these people that are watching a reality show at this bar, because it looks like a kind of a bar that would be like a sports bar.
Yeah.
Yes. So
it's funny that instead of watching sports, they're watching a reality show. And I guess more later on, you kind of would get more of that with like Survivor and The Bachelor and some of those kind of reality shows where it's more a community based kind of thing of everyone watching it together. And it really didn't have that one as yet in 98.
Right.
So it kind of looks like it's not real, but I guess in some ways it did kind of become real.
Yeah, later it did. On.
But to me, just that whole dynamic just was fun for me to watch because they all had different interests, whether it was, you know, whether they, you know, because it happens, you know, 24 hours a day, the Truman Show's on, and yet, you know, you have all these people at the bar watching it.
The reaction when they first shut down the transmission, the one waitress drops the drink. She's just like, the look on her face is just priceless. Oh, I love it. Oh, great answer. All right, Robert.
I almost went with the bar group. And if you notice, the bar is actually called the Truman Bar.
The Truman Bar, yeah.
It is like a sports bar, but it's a sports bar to watch Truman rather than to watch, you know, Major League Football. So I almost went with them and almost went with the waitresses. But I decided that I really liked the two garage attendants.
Oh, that's my answer, yes. Too. I love those guys.
Well, partly because they get the last word. Because, I mean, that part of me, the movie is, it is kind of a warning, or it's not just a feel-good movie. It's pretty satiric. And their whole thing with the, one of the slices of pizza, and what else do you want to watch? The end, boom. It just punches you with a face, kind of how, and shows how, you know, yeah, they were all invested in it until they didn't care. But I also liked it because... Because welcome to 2024. Things trend for 24 hours, then they're gone. You know, who talks about Stranger Things anymore? You know, who talks about
me?
Downton Abbey. Like, no, they had their weekend. Now we're on to the next thing. That's just how life is now. But anyway, no, I liked the two guys. And I also liked them partly because they did not seem like they would be fans of the show. Like, the bathtub guy is a psycho, and obviously we don't know what his deal is. He is very into the show. And then the bar, obviously that's fans of the shows, and the waitresses work there. And that, I mean, so get them. I love the different international families. That was really sweet and funny, kind of a trope of this. When you do that montage, you always show some international families.
Right.
But I did, you know, it's like these two kind of like burly working class garage guys, like, why are they watching this show? And yet they did have an interest in it. It was not just, they weren't channel hopping. They were definitely watching the show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they were.
And I was like, that the show, these guys were watching the show, made them interesting. But it also, the fact that they were so quick to get rid of it and move on was just the icing on the top of the cake.
Yeah. They're our first viewers and they're the first ones and the last ones we saw. So, all right, Amber.
I love the guy in the bathtub.
What? Oh, no.
If for no other reason than when Truman's in the boat, he's like clinging to the shower curtain, screaming, "Hold on, I can't do it." And I think that, and I love when he's cheering at the end and he's splashing water everywhere. Like, he's so funny to me.
That's got to be that guy's every night after work. He's got to come home, run a bath, and watch the Truman Show. And he just sits in there and falls asleep. It
feels like he's in there for like days.
It seems like that.
I think you're right.
It's a nightly ritual.
His little routine.
Yeah. That's actually quite, I'm shocked that anybody chose him, but that's, you know, that's,
I think,
funny.
He's so funny.
I did love that the one family, the mom and the daughter was playing with a house that was modeled after one of the Sea Haven houses, which I thought was great. Wonderful.
Well, and did anybody else notice that the Japanese family, the young guy, is the villain from Karate Kid 2?
Of course I did.
Yes. Did not see that.
I did. Yes. Nerd. Anyway, so I love the Truman coffee mugs, the Truman sweatshirts, the calendar that they drew a mustache on. So I love all the merchandise.
Well, those two old ladies, I don't know if they're a couple or if they're sisters or what, but like
they're
wearing Meryl's robe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have the pillows. They had like all the merch.
Oh, yeah.
There's something behind them. It was, I think it was a lamp or there's some kind of like object behind them that you also see in the Truman family's house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, they are just on that website ordering stuff as soon as the episodes are on.
That's right. They must have quite a retirement to be able to buy all that stuff. But anyway. Right. All right. So you can pick one or the other or both if you have an answer. Favorite Peter Weir or Jim Carrey film? So, Michael.
Favorite Jim Carrey film besides this one would probably be Man on the Moon.
That's good too.
Andy Kaufman, the Andy Kaufman biopic. You know, and it's the follow up to this film too. So it's he had a nice little back to back the late 90s there.
Yep.
Peter Weir, besides this one, it's Dead Poets Society. I love that film. The cast, obviously, but also it has kind of a sort of a connection to the area where I'm from, which is Tennessee. The writer of the film based his story on his experiences at his high school or the school that he went to. And it's Montgomery Bell Academy. And I know exactly where it was. When growing up, when I would go to Nashville, I'd go by there. And so, that having that kind of a personal connection too, even though it's, you know, very tangential,
right.
I always loved that film.
All right. Very good. All right, Robert.
Well, for a Jim Carrey film, I'd have to pick this one because I've not seen very many of his movies because I don't really care for him much. and the ones I have seen him in, like I saw the Lemony Snicket thing and I saw the other ones he'd done. He just doesn't do it for me as an actor, really. But I like this movie and I think he's fine in it. But Peter Weir, gosh, so many good movies. Dead Poets Society is great. This one might be the topper, but I'm going to go with Picnic at Hanging Rock because it was the first thing I saw of his, and it's just still such a strange and weird movie, and it was my introduction to him, too. So I have a real soft spot for Picnic at Hanging Rock.
All right. Yeah, my introduction to him was The Year of Living Dangerously, and then, of course, Dead Poets Society. And I went back years later to watch Gallipoli because I hadn't seen it until the 2000s, honestly. It was one of those I meant to see, and I finally got the chance to see it. So
how does it hold up? I saw it when it came out and remembered it liking it, but not, it didn't stick at all. So
I enjoyed it. I will say I enjoyed it. I was happy that I got around to watching it. So you know, it's just one of those you see, you hear about, and you're like, I need to watch it. So I definitely wasn't disappointed. I mean, he's okay. Made better, but that's not really hard. I mean, it's not like he really makes bad stuff for the most part. So although Green Card, whatever. But anyway. Oh, sorry, Amber. Did I step on your favorite?
You did.
Really? Oh. I thought for sure it was going to be Dead Poets Society.
You are joking.
Well, here's what I was going to say.
Okay.
Is that I actually, this is one of the few filmmakers that I like all of his movies.
Okay.
There really isn't a Peter Weir movie that I dislike. Now I haven't seen, you know, of course, some of his early things, and you know, Picnic at Hanging Rock was the first one that he made that I've seen. So I love them all. And okay. What I wanted to do is give a shout out to Green Card.
Okay,
because it is a delightful little film. And I just watched it right before the podcast, okay. And it's a delightful little romantic comedy. Bebe Neuwirth's in it. You can't go wrong. I mean,
right.
It's a cute little thing. So, and then my favorite Jim Carrey movie other than this one is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yes, because that's freaking fantastic.
And Kate Winslet, and it's all the things.
Kate Winslet makes my heart go thump. So with me, with Peter Weir, it comes down to either this or Dead Poets Society. And if I had to pick which one I'm going to watch again, it would probably be this one, because Dead Poets Society is way more emotional and at times a little hard to watch, but it's a fantastic movie. Like I said, Master Commander is amazing. If you have not seen it,
I will.
Where's the look for Witness on this podcast? Like Witness is straight up one of Harrison Ford's greatest.
But the thing, I've only seen it once and I've never gone back to it. And not that I didn't like it.
It's free on Prime right now. Right. Like when we're done, go
well,
stream.
To your point, Amber, Weir makes really good movies.
Right.
He doesn't make bad movies. I mean,
has anybody seen his last one, The Way Back?
I just started it last night, but it was too late to like get into World War II. So
yeah, it looks good. It looks like a good cast.
So what I saw was really good. I saw like the first half hour.
All right. Yeah, it would just be kind of a bummer because I always hate when people go out on a bad movie. You know, it's just, you know, like Sean Connery retired after League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I'm like, oh, that's a turd. So that's a bummer.
You didn't have one more in you?
Yeah, just one more. Sorry. Okay. So like I said, with Jim Carrey, it's either this or Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind, because everything Amber said. So there you go.
It's all very right. Romance.
Yeah. So good. So good. God, now am I going to watch that? What am I going to do this weekend? Anyway. Okay.
I know.
All right. Well, let's hit final words and a rating for this film. So Michael, you go first. 1 to 5 film reels.
I have to give it 4.5 out of 5. It's one of my, like, you know, I mentioned it's one of my favorite Jim Carrey films. It's one of my favorite Peter Weir films. I love the story. I love the cinematography. You know, we've mentioned the music. Love that too. It's just all around great film. And it's one that, like I said, I love revisiting it. I did an episode of it on my podcast. It's one that I always recommend people to check out. So high, high marks for it.
All right. All right. Amber.
I give it a 4, and I, you know, for completionists, if you have just discovered, say, Paul Giamatti, you know, because you watched The Replacements or whatever, you know, The Holdovers, excuse me.
The Holdovers are so good.
You know, you can say, like, check out this early thing that he did that's really awesome. And there's so many actors, you know, like, we've been singing Laura Linney's praises all night, you know. If you think you like this person, go watch The Truman Show, because there's so many amazing performances in it. It's just absolutely wonderful. And, you know, it's too bad that Peter Weir only ever made 13 movies, because
right?
Every single one of them is awesome in its own way and really enjoyable and worth your time.
All right. Robert?
Yeah, I'm going to give it a rare 5 reels as well. I think it is, yes, it's really exemplary. And what I love about this is even just our conversation. There's so many ways you can view this movie,
yes,
and appreciate it. And it does, as we've all said, it warrants rewatching in a way. There's movies that I have loved 5 level one time. And when you go back and see them later, they're just, they're not quite that, or it was just, you know, whatever. But this holds up over the years. It holds up over viewings, and it's got so many points of intersection that you can approach it by that it just is a great movie for everybody to see.
Yeah. So Robert and I are going to agree. Even with my minor complaints, it's a 5 for me. Because I had to dig for things I didn't like. And to Amber's point, she didn't like things, but it wasn't bad filmmaking. You know what I mean? You're supposed to not like Meryl. You know what I mean? And you're supposed to not like Christoph.
You're supposed to be upset.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's amazing to think, and you're right, there's very few movies like this being made anymore. And this was kind of ahead of the curve on the whole reality TV show thing. And the fact that, you know, we can all watch it and get something different out of it every time. And like I said, I only recent viewings really noticed all the different copies of Dog Fancy, all the different copies of, you know, Modern Dad, and all the different, you know, there's just so many things that they put in there, and in the love they put into the story that it's just so good. And I loved it first viewing, and it's only gotten better over the years. So yeah, it's a 5 for me. All right. Well, that was fun. A great conversation about a fantastic movie. So, Michael, before we get out of here, why don't you tell people about your podcast and where they can find you?
Yeah. So thanks for having me on.
Of course.
Always enjoy the conversation. I am the host of the Screen Nerds podcast. I always like to say it is a podcast for film lovers by film lovers. We get into reviews of new films right out of the theater, doing quick screen reviews, and then rescreen episodes are favorite films like this one of mine, where I go back and rewatch it and share thoughts and feelings of when I saw it for the first time, as well as thoughts on the latest rewatch. So you can find me anywhere you get your podcast. Just search Screen Nerds Podcast. And then on the socials, on Twitter, because I still call it Twitter.
So do I. It's,
yeah. It's Screen Nerds Pod, and then everywhere else, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, Threads, or Blue Sky, it's Screen Nerds Podcast. And again, thanks for having me on. I really appreciated it.
Of course. And of course, as always, thank you to my twins, they're either completely in agreement or completely opposite. So of course, thank you, Robert.
Thank you for having me. This was a great episode.
Thank you, Amber.
Thank you, buddy. I loved it.
And of course, thank you to the listeners for spending time with us. It does mean quite a bit that you spend time with us every week. So thank you very much. Reach out on social media. All of our information is in the show notes. Let us know what you think of The Truman Show, Peter Weir, Jim Carrey, and anybody else in the cast. Do us a favor, rate and review the podcast on whatever app you use. If we see the review and the rating, we will gladly share it on an episode as well as on social media. If you'd like to help us other ways, you can share us with your family and friends. You know, it's always great to have more people. If you like it, cool, share us, make them happy. And if you don't like us and you want to punish people, that's fine too. So if you really enjoy what you're doing, what we're doing, join us over on Patreon. For as little as $1 a month, you get access to exclusive content, what I like to call either bonus tracks, which are music episodes, or deleted scenes, which are movie episodes. These are things that we couldn't quite get into the schedule, but we still want to cover. Recent episodes include the review of Cowboys from Hell from Pantera. Our next episode is actually going to be a review of Frehley's Comet. It's the debut album from Ace Frehley when he left Kiss. And some upcoming movies include Wizards, Mr. Holland's Opus, and Vision Quest. To round out the month, we have a couple of Versus episodes set up for you. Next week, it is Chicken Run versus Shrek. I'm super excited about that one. And Armageddon versus Deep Impact. There's a lot of strong feelings on that episode. Just saying, and get ready for it. Do yourself a favor, watch more movies. And remember, physical media is better than streaming. Oh, and in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. The Docking Bay 77 podcast is produced and edited by Dayton Johnson, recorded with Rode Pod Mics, the Zoom PodTrack P4, and edited on Audacity. Opening music provided by Eric Jason Brock. You can find him on YouTube and Bandcamp. Thank you for listening. I've been to enough movies that almost got ruined because people in the theater just wouldn't shut up. And I'm okay during the opening. I'm okay during the previews. But once the opening credits start, shut up.
It's like, it's all about the Monday matinee. God bless the Monday matinee. You know, you're usually the only one there.
See, and that's why I like the midnight showings, because it was just a bunch of us nerds there for the same reason.
Fair,
and you know, had the respect. Yes. But, you know, Sunday evening, you got everybody and their sister showing up, and it's just like, be quiet.
Although we went years ago on Hollywood Boulevard, we went to the premiere of Empire Strikes Back at midnight, and every single character got 3 minutes of shrieking and entrance applause and cheers, to where I basically had to like buy another ticket and go see it a few days later so I could hear the majority of the dialogue. Like, here comes Luke. For 3 minutes, and here comes, you know.
Yeah, anyway. That's kind of fantastic.
It was a great experience, but it was not a good movie going experience.
Yeah. All right. That's fair. Yeah. I had three people completely ruin Eyes Wide Shut for me, just completely, to the point where it was over. I literally screamed at them for 5 minutes and walked out of the theater. I tried to bait them into a fight. I was that angry. I tried to bait them into a fight. I was ready to go to jail.
Honestly, over Eyes Wide Shut though?
They were laughing and giggling the whole time, like, you know, they were teenagers.
That would be true, but...
Yeah.
Did you use the mouths wide shut joke? I would have started with the mouths wide shut joke and then gone on from there.
No.
Like, your eyes can be wide open, but your mouths have to... Anyway.
Yeah, no.
Sorry about that. But luckily, as Amber said, it wasn't a very good movie, so you didn't miss much.
I know, but that's the problem. I just have that memory, and I need to... I want to watch it again just so I can... confirm my feelings of that film that weren't, you know, tainted. But anyway, all right. We have totally derailed so many things. And of course, I'm working on our top 7 90s movies list, which I've got it down to 11. I got it down to 11.
So I totally forgot that I was going to be on that one. So I haven't even started my list yet.
Oh, you've got homework.
I have a lot of work to do.
I went through my collection and literally just pulled out any that might make the list. And at one point I had 25. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
And that was already after eliminating anything we've already discussed or we're going to discuss. So this one went off, you know, Go, yeah. Pleasantville, all those we've talked about, Seven, all those we did episodes on, it went away.
It's funny, yeah. I thought, oh, the 90s, I don't, yeah, I went, but I can't remember anything. And then I pulled up a list of like 100 best movies in the 90s. I was like, I love that movie. I love that movie. I know, same thing. I have like probably a dozen, same thing. I brought up like a dozen of them from the basement on DVD and said, well, got to rewatch all these. Clunk. Yep. And then there's the ones I got to stream, you know,
yeah.
to revisit. And yeah, there were a lot of good things.